Price drop? Time to shop. Get to a Nordstrom Rack store today for first dibs on new markdowns. Now score even more, up to 70% off brands everyone loves at Nordstrom Rack. Denim, dresses, sneakers, tops, and more. Plus, get genius deals on jackets, sweaters, and boots for the whole family. Shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and save up to 70% with new markdowns. But hurry, deals this great won't last.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to another episode, another edition of The Three Questions with Andy Richter. I'm Andy Richter, so remember this voice because that's who I'll be throughout the entire thing. And I am lucky enough to talk to a very funny woman who I don't know that we've ever met. I don't think we ever have we?
No, I would have remembered.
I mean, I don't mean to sound like a shallow Hollywood phony, but I probably wouldn't have. Because I meet lots and lots of famous people all the time here in Burbank. No, I really have. It is a weird situation to be in where you're like, you know, like Robin Thicke. Do I just know about Robin Thicke or have I met Robin Thicke? You know, like things like that where it's.
Why would you choose Robin Thicke?
I don't know. It's just what came to mind. Well, anyway, I'm talking to Amber Ruffin. That's who I'm talking to. She's obviously in her office because I recognize that radiator over by the window, that old timey radiator. That's Rockefeller Center. Yeah.
You've been here, buddy.
I have. Isn't it fun to work in that building? Doesn't it feel like you're a big time showbiz grown up when you do that?
It really does. Nothing is better than freaking like hurrying down the hallway and you have your sketch on your,
iPad?
On your iPad, tablet, and you're making changes on the fly. It's the best. Yeah.
Or you mean clipboard?
Clipboard.
Yeah, clipboard. Now, what night do you guys tape your show?
We tape Ruffin Show on Fridays at 1:45.
Okay.
We tape Late Night with Seth Meyers Monday through Thursday at 4 p.m.
Okay. So you're still working full time for Seth, or are you just doing
occasional? Yeah.
Oh my God, that's not fair. Some of us don't even have jobs anymore. Well, now how come you wrangled that sort of deal? Was it just because you're under the same kind of production umbrella and they're like.
Yeah, they produce my show.
Yeah, yeah.
And Seth like, Schumacher.
You don't just get your own show and you can't focus on your own show. Seth Meyers is like, no, you're still mine.
Look, Late Night with Seth Meyers is so easy. I could do a third show.
Oh, what a dicky thing to say. People out here wanting just something, anything. You're like, I can do a third show. And aren't you like writing a play or something too on the side?
I'm writing a Broadway musical too. Yeah.
Oh my God.
And that from the future, that will prove the bridge too far. that was where my eyes got too big for my stomach.
Why do you think your parents didn't pay enough attention to you?
Thank you for asking. I'm the youngest of five.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
But aren't you though
the baby then? I mean, you know, of course I'm joking about, you know, the needing attention, but
I am the baby, and that means just leave the baby alone. Let her do what she feels like doing. That's what being the baby gets you.
I know.
Yeah. No one's gonna beat you up or make fun of you. And you're only allowed to talk to me like this. And that's how I became terrible. I was truly babied within an inch of my life.
I don't know how much I believe in all the birth order stuff, but like, who do you think is the most healthy? of your siblings. And there's, is there five? Is that what it is?
I'm the youngest of five.
Wow. Yeah.
The healthiest of my siblings is the middle child, actually.
Really? Yeah.
Lacey, is my sister, is the middle child, and she's the only normal person the Ruffins have to offer. And you can tell my siblings I said it. They know. Don't tell them I said it.
Why is that? Do you think, did she have kind of the classic sort of taken care of everybody kind of middle child? Or was she also, was she kind of left alone too and able to form herself?
I think she was left alone too. Well, no, she did a really good job and she got really good grades. She did very well.
Yeah.
And then she was also like very kind and nice. Whereas the rest of us are kind of like, maybe not, but a lot of us are like rowdy. Like I'm kind of rowdy.
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
if I'm talking to you and you say something funny, I'm going to grab your arm and then shake like rowdy.
Yeah. Like yeah. That. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Like a, like a rodeo cowboy.
Exactly. I get in a barrel, I taunt a bull, and then whatever happens, happens.
Yeah, yeah. yeah, because I do think the younger kid does get the benefit of, in some ways, it seems counterintuitive, but I think it's the least stressed parents. Because by this point, they know you're not going to die. You know, like they know they're not going to kill you. Because when you have a baby, you're just afraid you're going to, this thing's going to die. You're going to, you know, because it seems so helpless and so little. And you think, oh my God. And then after a couple of them, you're like, oh no, these things, they live, you know, yeah. You feed them, you put them somewhere, you know, keep them from making too much noise and yeah, and they'll be fine. Now, where did you grow up? I know I saw it, but.
I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska.
Oh, that's right.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Illinois. I grew up in, central northern Illinois, a town called Yorkville, which is about 70 miles west of Chicago.
And then you did Chicago.
And then I went into Chicago. Yeah, like you did too. Yeah, because that was kind of, you know, it was the closest draw. You actually got pulled to Chicago. I just was in Chicago. And
that's
so,
cool.
Yeah, I mean, my first improv class, which I took, I was working in film production. Because I'd gone to film school in Chicago. I started at University of Illinois in a big ten school down there. And I went there 2 years and then I decided I wanted to do film school and I couldn't afford New York or Los Angeles to big fancy film school. So I went to Columbia College, which at the time had what they call, they actually referred to it in the literature as a liberal admissions policy, which meant if you can get a Pell Grant, come on in, you know, you don't need to read that well. It's no problem, you know. And I think it's much more legit now. Like it used to be like three buildings in the South Loop. And now it's like the entire South Loop is Columbia College.
Yeah.
But I got a good education. I got a very kind of practical film education. And I left there and worked in film production and learned more on 2 weeks of working on commercials than I did at 2 years of film school, as it always is the case. And then I wanted to perform and I started taking improv classes at IO. And in my first improv class, I sat next to a kid that had moved there from Phoenix because he wanted to be on SNL. And I was like, what? This is like a fun Saturday morning thing for me. What? it was kind of daunting in a way, you know, but yeah, no, I was glad. Cause I don't know if I'd been in Omaha. I don't know if I would have, you know, had the nerve to leave. I mean, I left Yorkville to move to Chicago, but so I don't know, but yeah, that was probably, I mean, how did you expect to be in Omaha? Like when you were a kid, did you think I'm going to be here?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought I was going to live in Omaha forever.
Yeah.
And I was going to deliver the mail. That was what I thought.
Really? Why that?
Because it's a job.
Like the uniform?
I just love a good, I love a good khaki short.
Yeah, a sensible walking shoe.
A pith helmet? Are those hats they wear? I'm not sure what the hat is.
I bet you got to bring those from home. I don't think they provide you with pith helmets.
I think you get a safari helmet. I'm pretty sure. But no, I really thought I was going to work at the... And I was like, I will work in the day, and then at night I'll be, you know, the part of the chorus in whatever musical is downtown. Andy, I couldn't even imagine getting a speaking role.
Oh my goodness.
In downtown Omaha, Nebraska. That's how never gonna leave I was. Wow. I was never gonna leave. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I did not see it.
Well, first of all, you had the urge to get on stage. You know, yeah. I mean, you were that much of an extrovert. Was that something that had older siblings done that, or was that just something that you pushed for yourself?
That kind of just happened to me because when I was in kindergarten, I could read. And when you did shows at school, you like read a thing. Hey, I'm a pilgrim, and I arrived at this time, and Thanksgiving is the time. So, you know, kid has to read it. So I was always
the star
person because I could read.
Yeah.
And that's the only time it's ever come to Andy. And I would do that. And then in church, I was learning how to play the piano. I'd had two lessons. And then the lady who was teaching me, for some reason could not be the piano player anymore. Now, I think she did something the church didn't like, so they made her stop. Wow. But I have no proof of that.
Right.
But I'm just saying that's the rumor. So then I just had to
Did anyone have an idea of what the rumor was?
Like, rumor was she cheated on her husband.
Oh,
that's the rumor.
That's ever really a problem at church. You know, come on.
You can't play the piano anymore. You cheated on your, that makes no earthly sense. But okay. I mean, she's still there. I'm
right. Right.
It.
Right.
So then I just had to figure out how to play the piano, and I had to figure out how to tell people what to sing. And then I had to, then that evolved into me leading praise and worship.
Yeah.
Every Sunday. And then I really never sat and thought about this, but it wasn't a thing I was after. It was a thing I was pushed into everywhere. Yeah.
And what age were you? Did you become the church soloist?
1991. And so I was not yet born because I'm so young. No, I think I was.
Wow. Those little hands reaching out of your mother to hit the keyboard. And the other woman was a problem? Your mother was in stirrups in front of the piano.
I think that makes me 12.
Well, 12, Jesus, 12. That is like,
I know what I'm saying.
Because church is a show, you know, church is theater. That's I always, you know, I mean, because I was involved in our church too. You know, always being unencumbered by a belief in God, but still enjoying like the whole, you know, community aspect of it and all the different stuff you'd get to do. And, you know, a lot of my friends were involved in their families went to this church. And you know, I was even like the youth deacon and stuff. So, and my brother would say to me, "You don't even believe in God." And I'm like, "Yeah, what's that got to do with anything?" You know, like, that's, you know, you can belong to any club you want. Yeah. So then that just sort of evolved, and you just kind of found yourself, and you just kind of had to learn to deal with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now,
it was very, very fun.
Do you think that that kind of mechanism of being like, "Here, you go do this," helped you in the sort of the being in the daunting position of launching your own show?
Yes. Like, I feel like all those things happened to me because I was like, fuck it, I'll do it. You know, there are those t-shirts that say, fuck it, I'll do it. And then it's credited black women. And that's kind of like the whole
like, well,
no one else. I might as well take care of this. I bet you I could. So it is like that. And it is like, well, I wrote this thing yesterday. we got to do it tomorrow. It'll probably be fine. let me just slap together some choreography.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah. You get it. It's always cutest. I always said, like the Conan show, it was a train that you're laying tracks for, and you can hear it. It's coming, you know, and you're laying tracks. So it's like you don't have time, like, to worry about it. You just got to get them laid and get on, you know, and move on. And and never, you know, early on, Conan would have, we'd have a bad show and Conan would freak out. And I would say, you know, because when we started, I kind of had more stage time than he did when we started doing the show. Because he had done the Groundlings, but I had done Improv Olympic and Annoyance Theater and done, you know, just had more stage time. And he would freak out and be like, oh my God, that show is awful. And I'd be like, yep, it's a shame we don't get to do another one, you know? And then, like 9 months later or 10 months later, I don't know, a year later, he said to me one time, he goes like, you know, it's like, that was not a great show, but I always tell myself, well, we always get to do another one tomorrow. And I was like, I told you that. You didn't come up with that on your own. God damn it. I told you that. Well, now you also did, you started doing improv as a kid too, right? Is there an Omaha improv scene?
There was. You don't happen to know Fuzzy and Sean, do you?
I do not.
There were
some. Sounds like a children's show.
It is. The Adventures of Fuzzy and Sean. No, Fuzzy and Sean were some improv guys in Chicago, and their third was a major in the Air Force, like an Air Force pilot. And he lived in Omaha because we have a big Air Force thing. Uh-huh. And he started a group, Matt Martin. And then we started improvising. And once we went to Chicago for Chicago Improv Festival, and I took a class from Sharna, the lady who runs Improv Olympic. Mm-hmm. And she said, if you move here, you'll have a job within a year. And then I did. And I did. I got hired at Boom Chicago. Yeah.
Wow. That's one time Sharna's been right. I love you, Sharna. I'm just kidding. Well, that's amazing. I mean, and how did your family react to that? Like, and had you been in college at that point, or
I've never gone to college for a minute.
Wow.
How old was I? 21.
Oh, wow. And why no college? Did you just, it wasn't for you, or?
I just never really considered it.
Really?
I know that's awful, but I'm just not. Like, all my siblings did go to college, but after, like, they were out in the world for a while, and then they're like, okay, I got to go to college. And then everyone has gone to college since. But
yeah.
I don't know. Also, no one's forcing me to do shit. I'm the baby. Right.
That's all right.
How are we cussing on here?
You can say whatever the fuck you want.
Fuck balls.
Fuck shit. Yeah. Fuckity fuck. Well, that's good. I mean, like, I have a younger brother who went to the Navy because he wasn't sure if he wanted to go to college. And, like, within 5 minutes of being in the Navy, he's like, I want to go to college. Yeah. So, yeah, I think sometimes it does take that. Well, so how did your folks feel about I'm packing up and moving to Chicago? And
They did not give two shits.
Really?
They really didn't. Because at that point, my oldest sister used to live in Panama, and my second oldest sister used to live in Namibia.
Oh, wow.
So me going to Chicago from Omaha was nothing. And they were bye, you know. So it wasn't scary for them at all. Also, like, I have an aunt and an uncle who live in Chicago, so it didn't feel like I was out in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, yeah. That does help a lot. And did you stay with them when you first moved there? Or?
No, I don't think I saw them once.
Oh, wow. Well, fuck that.
But I do remember, like, it did provide great comfort.
Right, just in case. Yeah.
Just in case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can show up on their door bloody and say, like, I just committed a crime. I've come to implicate you. well, I mean, what was it like going from Omaha to Chicago and going, I mean, is this the first time that you really kind of seriously felt like, okay, I can do this for a living?
Yeah. Yes. Well, first of all, it was my first time on a plane when I went to Chicago. And then I took all those classes. Sharna let me intern. So I interned at IO and had just the freaking best time. And I would call my mom and be like, Mom, the lady I work for has me buying cheeseburgers and she's going to feed them to the dog. And we would laugh and laugh.
Yep, that sounds really like Sharna.
I am buying cheeseburgers for a dog. Like, must be nice. This dog gets a cheeseburger every day. For me, it's just, it's a weekly, fingers crossed, I have enough leftovers.
You have enough for cheese,
Yeah, meanwhile, I'm giving the cheeseburger to this dog, like, oh, enjoy it, buddy. but I forget what I was talking about.
Well, what was it like to move there? And was it daunting? And did you, you know, was this, how do you transfer, how do you go from Omaha to like, I'm going to make it in show business?
I never, ever thought I'm going to make it in show business. I always thought if they'll pay me to be dicking around, I'll do it.
Yeah.
You know, and I never gave any thought to the next thing. I was always like, how can I stay paid? And that's it. Like, I certainly wasn't like making big moves. I still wasn't. I got this job at Seth and was like, okay, I'm just going to keep my head down and be quiet. And then they started putting me in things and I was like, oh, okay.
Okay.
I better figure out how to do it like this then.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but you, no, go ahead. You were going to say something.
No, but I was just going to say, but it didn't, it was, that's the way to do it though. Like you had just said that your friend was like, I moved here from Phoenix to try to get on SNL. Like that was not my experience in Chicago. And Chicago to me, these people were like, we live and die on the stage and we're the brothers and blah, 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 like a bunch of hippies. Whereas out here in New York, people are like, look, I have goals. But in Chicago, it wasn't really like that. Were you in Chicago? Do you feel like people were like, I'm doing this as a stepping stone to the next thing? Or were people like, oh, well.
There were some that had that vibe and might even overtly say things like that. And everyone sort of rolled their eyes about it. You know what I mean? Like they were the ones, like they were the ones that sort of, like we had a splinter group that we took off from Sharna at one point called the Comedy Underground. And it was a scandal. Sharna, the Improv Olympic was at that time, it was in I don't know if it's still called, it was called Papa Milano. And it was a restaurant, an Italian restaurant that was on Lincoln, and I don't remember the cross street, but it was like one of those wedge, you know how like the cross was diagonal. It was like a wedge building, and above was a Italian restaurant, and then below was kind of like a bar party space. And Sharna, that was where the Improv Olympic was, and I was just a co-conspirator. I wasn't like one of the connivers. But we split off. There was like, we were having these secret meetings, like, let's start our own thing. Cause it was kind of, you know, we'd have gotten experience under our belt. And
wait, so you didn't misspeak. That's where IO was?
Yes. Oh. It was in the basement of an Italian restaurant.
Oh, and I didn't know that.
When I first started, it was in the second floor of an Italian restaurant. It had on Wells Street, a restaurant called Chow. What? She didn't have her own building until after I left town. Actually, when it started, it was above a blues club off of Belmont called Cotton Chicago. James Cotton had a blues club, and it was in the top floor there was where she was doing classes and doing shows. I think there was a downstairs space that she'd get that she would do shows at, but it would have to be split with blues acts, you know. And then it went from there to down to Wells Street. And then after that, it went to this other, she was always looking for a space and always getting kicked out. And, you know, And then we these two guys were friends with these two brothers that, you know, and like classic Italian Chicago restaurant owner brothers. They got chummy with them and they kicked Sharna out and we moved into that spot. So we made Sharna homeless, which
that
was
is
like,
a scandal.
It didn't feel great, but you know, it was like one of those first lessons and kind of like, well, it's going to happen anyway. Like these guys, you know, cause these brothers had made it clear, like, no, we're going to get rid of Sharna no matter what. So it was like, well, okay, then we'll take over this space, which it didn't last very long anyway. And actually a couple, these same two guys, after a short time of being there, had decided that we hadn't progressed enough and we needed to dissolve the group.
And, oh.
Yeah. And which we were, everyone was like, no one else here felt that way. And it was actually me. And I was always the youngest. So it was like, it was one of the first times of really stepping out, you know, in front of a group and saying, I don't, and everyone, you know, they're also fucking passive. They're like, okay, I guess if this is the way it is. And then I went like, wait a minute, what? I got nothing else to do. Like, this is fun. I love doing this and it's good work. And we really were, it was like the best improv I ever did. It was, you know, like those magical times when stuff comes out of your mouth and you don't even know where it's coming from. Like you surprise yourself with like, holy shit, that was a good one. I don't remember thinking of that. It just came out. And the two guys that were trying to dissolve it were pissed because then I sort of swayed everyone. Cause the other guys who had been like, yeah, I guess we should break up. Were like, no, you know what? I guess we should stay together. You know, like just so infuriating, like improv guy, you know, yes. Anding everything. And so we stayed together for a little while, but then it all, you know, kind of fell apart. And those guys were two guys that were totally like open about their ambition to be something and do something. And I just didn't, I was like, I don't know. It just, I'm like you. I was like, I can't even conceive. Well, first of all, for me to say like, I want to be on SNL just seemed like oh my God, what, get a load of Big Shot over here thinking that he can just will himself on TV, you know, just kind of Midwestern, like, take it easy, buddy. And I also wasn't even like, I'm like, I don't know. Is that what I'm going to do? I think I also thought like, I'll probably just end up writing ad copy because it was Chicago. But yeah, I'm the same thing. I just kind of went from opportunity to opportunity of like, okay, yeah, I'll do that. And okay, yeah, I'll do that. And, you know, and I never really, and I didn't have any concrete plan. You know, but I didn't get my own show in Rockefeller Center. I had to latch on to somebody else.
You had to be his anchor. What studio were you guys in?
We were in 6A.
Yeah.
Which is where, that's where Seth is now, right? Or is that where
Fallon? We're at studio, we're right next to SNL on 8.
Oh,
Fallon
right.
Is studio 6B. You had studio 6A. Which is the one that changes
all the time.
A lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because when we were there, we were in 6A and across the hall was Live at 5, was like the news. and so we shared all kinds of space with like, you know, like the news anchors became like our buddies. Like, oh, hey, hi there. Chuck Scarborough and Sue Smith, I think was her name. But when we started working there too, people could smoke. You'd see like people running down the hall with tapes to put in the local news, smoking cigarettes, running down the hall. It felt very Lou Grant, very kind of Mary Tyler Moore-ish being there.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
It and still I feels think, that way.
Does it?
Yes.
It's amazing to me just the stuff that like, that building is so, when you think about like all the cables running around in that building, like from one studio to another, and there'd be times when something'd be edited late and they would have to roll it from the edit room. And like, you know, like how I just, the technology involved and just like the most complicated AV setup ever. And it's all in that building.
Yeah.
In fact, some of those wires caught fire. Some of those cables caught fire once, and we had to do our show outdoors for a couple.
Really?
Of yeah. Yeah. We had to, yeah, we had to, we ended up doing the show out by the ice skating rink, and it was like late fall, and Samuel L. Jackson gave me a foot massage. I remember, I will always remember that night for that. I don't know. It just happened. It's like a dream. I still think of it. Just get all giddy.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because... I got the charcoal mask. Great, because why would I put that on my face when I could drop it in my sink? This is what I get for multitasking. Ugh, why is charcoal so sticky?
Hello?
Hey, Janice. I am so sorry. I thought I was on mute. No, we don't need to reschedule. I'll just stay off camera. Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
you were in, you did what a lot of people, I mean, what a number of notables have done, including, I think, Seth. Didn't Seth do Amsterdam, or was it his brother that did? Seth did Amsterdam, yeah.
Yeah.
Boom Chicago is like a place that you go when you do improv in Chicago and you realize, I'm not going to make him enough money here. I go to Amsterdam and make some money there doing improv. And what was that like?
Boom Chicago was the freaking best. Like, we would, you know, we had like a regular 300 seat theater, like in the heart of Amsterdam, huge. And it was like, back when I was there, being there was kind of a big deal a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like, if you said, I work at Boom Chicago, people would go, oh, are you an actor? Oh, you know.
In Amsterdam, or you mean anywhere? Yeah.
Oh, nowhere else in the world.
Yeah.
But
and did
in Amsterdam, people cared a little.
Did they recruit you, or did you, like, apply and try and get in?
Yep. Every year they would go to L.A., New York, and Chicago and audition people.
Yeah.
And I auditioned in Chicago and got it and was there for 2 years. And it was just like the first, I'm going to say like year and 3 months was just horrible. It was horrible.
The early
part of
it? I
did a bad job. Yep. I did a bad job. I had a horrible time. I did not like it. But I was eating a full dinner every night. I love that.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, love dinner, being able to eat.
When you're hungry, dinner hits the spot. That's for sure.
Every night. So I just had a very bad time. And it was like the vibe wasn't good. It was a bad vibe then. It was a bad vibe time. And then it just, everything changed and like the actors changed. And then it was the most fun I've ever had in my life. I mean, it was always the most fun. But
right.
During the shows, I would be like, oh, I'm doing a bad job. But, then when it got good and I got good at the job, I was like, there will never be anything this fun. So then I left and I called Second City on the telephone and asked for a job, and they gave me a job.
Oh, wow.
Second City, Denver. Okay. So I had just visited Second City and I did, you know how you can sit on the bench in Chicago and then do the set after the show, you could perform.
Yeah.
the day I went, Martin Short was there. So all of the people who make decisions at Second City were also there. Martin Short, I was like, oh, well, I don't get to do the set because Martin Short's here, but it's cool. I get to see Martin Short. Martin Short did not want to do the set. So I got to do the set. And it was
like, in front of everybody. Yeah.
In front of everyone. And it was like Slumdog Millionaire. The only suggestions were things I just so happened to know everything about. Like it was like sign language, gymnastics, and like one was spark plugs. And I just so happened to know where a spark plug is and how to install a new one. I was like, these people must think I'm a genius. I only know four things, and you shouted out three of them. It was the best. It was the best size. Slumdog Millionaire. It was like, that was a fucking excellent set. And it was. And then when I called, they were like, yes, actually, you can have a job. We're creating a Second City Denver. So then I did Second City Denver for a year, more than that, too. I don't know. And then we did We Existed, and it was great. And then I was like, okay, I'm going back to Boom Chicago. And they were like, no, will you do Main Stage? And I was like, oh, yeah, great.
Whoa, so then
I
did Main Stage. Yeah. Right. Like,
you should have said that.
Yeah.
So then I did. But they were like, come back and tour. I was like, but I am hungry for food.
Yeah.
And Turco is not going to do it.
Yeah.
So then I did.
I don't want to live in a van. Because that's,
I don't want to live
in a van. Yeah.
Sure, I know, but I do feel like I did miss Turco. But I did Main Stage for 2 years. Then I went back to Boom Chicago. Boom Chicago, you do a lot of tour shows. Like there's enough actors to do two corporate shows and one home show. So you were always doing all of them.
Yeah.
So we'd be like, hey, welcome to Brussels, Shell Oil. Now, here's a special song that goes out to Barry Jenkins. He's one crazy CEO. And you'd have to do that like four times a week. You would have to do that.
Yeah.
And it was the best because you never knew what was going to happen.
Like, yeah.
Sometimes you step out and that you can feel the hate.
Yeah.
They just hate that you're talking when all they want to do is have a beer.
An indifference that's like aggressive about something. You know what I mean? Like how you can like actively not care about them, you know?
Yes. So, I mean, we performed shows literally all over Europe, everywhere. Wow. And it was the most fun because sometimes you would know the sketch. Sometimes you didn't look at it enough. Sometimes you would have to get there and they'd be like, we don't like the sketch. And you'd have to be like, oh my God. So you'd have to change the sketch, learn it, and then do it. So it really like, you'll never feel uncomfortable again after doing a show like that. And most of it's improv. You'll never feel uncomfortable on a stage. So I
completely agree. Yeah.
And then you go and you perform with other adults and then you see how they act. And it's like, oh, you've never been unprepared in your life.
Right.
I'm sure it feels great, but it's not good for you.
No.
We call it cowboying it.
Yeah,
just like, hey, buddy, get out there and cowboy it. And if you haven't had to do that, you should.
Yeah. Yeah, because
you really should.
You get nerves or whatever word, you know, balls or, you know, chutzpah. You get like this kind of, which isn't like, it's not a swagger necessarily. It's just sort of like, oh, no, I can, you know, it's like, I don't know. It is like sort of a low level trauma. And trauma, you know, trauma does, once you kind of live with trauma on a regular basis, you get, you know, your shit gets together and you're like, all right, you know, this is nothing. I can handle this, you know.
Yeah.
You know,
I can be a low level.
It is. It's like, oh God, it's like an entire room full of people hating you. That sucks. You know?
Oh my, I mean, the hate, if there was a better word for hate, I mean, when when the show starts, those bad shows, what you feel then is hate. Then after you finished a whole hour,
mm-hmm.
it's something deeper.
It's people that hated you, but that you hadn't taken an hour of their time. Now you've got those two things together. I also want to ask, do you think that, like, sort of getting to do all of that work and getting all of that stage time out of the context of what is in any way sort of relevant to showbiz here in the States, do you think that it's like another kind of version of, you know, a safe place to fail?
Yes. And yeah. that, I think that's all it is. Like, once you've had the worst possible show a human being can have, then you wake up the next day and you have to do another show. And then you realize, oh, none of this is anything. So I might as well be balls out forever. And the way you perform changes, because you know, ultimately, the only thing that's going to stick is how much fun you had. That's it.
Yeah, yeah.
So once you figure that out, and it takes forever to figure out, I really do think you have to be all the way embarrassed to be a good performer. Like, you have to have, like, if an audience didn't make you cry, and I don't know that I've ever cried, but I'm not the cryingest guy. But, like, if an audience has never really made you have a very sad day or two, then I don't know how good a performer you're going to be. You got to have a bad time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think it's similar to, and this is something I didn't have to do until on the Conan show, we would occasionally do bits that were like fake nudity. Like, you know, like it'd be like we're supposed to be naked, and it'd be pixeled out, but we'd be wearing what's called a dance belt, which, for people don't know, it's like a one strap jock strap. It's a waistband and then a center strap and a pouch. And it's flesh color, or at least it's Caucasian flesh color, the one that I had. And the first time that I ever had to do that, you know, like, you get in, you put that thing on and you get in a robe and then you go out onto a set and you're like, oh, it's just like, oh fuck. You know, and I mean, you know, it's like, it's also that thing of where you know that your nudity is going to be comedy nudity. Whereas other, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, it's funny that guy thinks he should show that thing, that body, you know, like that can only be a joke. You know, the vessel in which he exists, as opposed to, you know, like, pretty people, it's like, it's not funny. Like, their nudity is cool. But I always was struck by, once the robe came off, it was done. It was like, oh, I'm not going to get any more naked. You know, I'm not going to get any more revealed. So, oh, I don't, you know, and then I would, like, you know, probably do actionable things, like, you know, put my leg up on somebody's chair and, you know, just like, how's it going over here? You know, because, you know.
And it might as well.
It was all family anyway. You know, we all knew each other at that point anyway. But yeah, it's good to be humiliated. If you're going to do this, because that's always a risk, and you might as well. It's like, you know, it's like inoculation. It's like you're getting little doses of it where, you know, to inoculate you against the big scales that you might get when you're, you know, doing your own show or something.
Yeah.
Now, according to my research, you married a Dutchman. Would you care to defend that?
I was drunk.
Oh, boy.
I didn't know. No, I did. I just spent so much time in Holland. I spent a total of 5 years there.
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised it happened.
Is your husband a comedian in any way, or...?
No.
No, he's a bummer. He is not funny.
Real downer. He's actually a painter.
Oh, wow.
He married a Dutch painter.
Wow.
And he paints beautiful paintings. Uh-huh. But he is, I mean, he's hilarious. But when I married him, he was absolutely not funny. Like, yeah. It just wasn't. And also, I was doing comedy every minute of every day. And every night I had a show, no matter what. It was constant.
Yeah.
So I didn't need him to be funny, but I saw that he felt like he was funny. And I was like, I think that's cute. Then we've been together 10 years. And now I understand the man is hilarious. Mm-hmm. It's just when we first got together, my Dutch wasn't good enough understand the structure of the jokes.
Yes,
and now I understand very clearly. He's absolutely hilarious. I just needed to understand the nuances of Dutch.
Yeah.
In order to get it. And now, you know, in his language, he's fucking hilarious. And in English, it's pretty close too.
It's getting good. Yeah, yeah. Do you speak Dutch at home? You know, or is it a split?
I never think we do, but then sometimes at the end of the day, I'll be like, I think we spent most of the day speaking Dutch.
Wow.
I think what happens a lot is he will speak Dutch and then I will respond in English. And then when we go out in public, we will both speak Dutch so that no one knows what we're talking about.
Right.
And then if we're around friends, then we speak English.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Friends should just let you speak. What a downer. Let you have your secret language together. You know?
I love our secret language.
Yeah, yeah.
It really is. It's so cool to have a secret language.
Uh-huh. I bet it would be. Yeah.
Yeah. Now and people hear you speak it and go,
yeah.
Because Dutch doesn't sound good.
Oh, no.
It sounds bad. Truly the ugliest language.
The first time I've been there just for vacation a couple of times, which I always found, because my ex-wife and I loved Amsterdam. Just it's such a beautiful, relaxed town. And we were coming from New York City, and it was kind of like a pretty green New York City in that you go to a restaurant, you go have coffee, you hang out, you know, just like it's kind of a cafe kind of life. But so, you know, with the canals, it's just a gorgeous place. And it's very easy too, because everybody speaks English. But every time here you go like, oh, we went to Amsterdam, people be like, oh, like,
yeah.
You know, like you're just like, yeah, to get high and go to the red light district, which I mean, like we walked not the length, but across the red light district once. And I was like, ew, no, thank you. No, thank you. This is, you know, nothing.
The
against
vibe is
sex
murder.
Workers. But yeah, it is. It's,
the vibe is different. It's not what you think it's
it
going to be.
It doesn't feel sexy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
It feels scary.
Scary. It feels like you shouldn't be there for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. People are always like, oh, you know, Amsterdam is, the first time when we first got there, we were staying at the Amstel Intercontinental, which is a nice hotel. And I don't know if it's even still there, but
the Amstel Hotel, the big, gorgeous hotel on the river.
Yeah. 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 Well, you know, I was on TV then. no kids yet either. So, but, the taxi driver we got in, we said, we're going to the Intercontinental, and he went, Amstel Intercontinental. And I was just like, oh my God, Dutch is just, it's like hawking up a loogie with every sentence.
It's a bad time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's bad.
Did you start learning it right away when you got there, or was it kind of?
Yeah. Evolved? I'm a language guy.
Oh, okay.
I'm a language guy. I love languages. I love learning them, and I really do think I'm good at it, but that might not be true. I think I might just be willing to sound like an idiot.
Yeah, yeah.
No, but I really, they made us take Dutch classes. I think we are the only generation of Boom Chicago who they made take Dutch classes.
Oh, wow.
We took it. It was super fun. I had a great time. I love a class.
I would love to have an excuse to learn a different language, and because that's the only way I ever do
Dutch.
Anything is if it's forced on me, you know? So, you end up, you come back, you go to, do you go to New York to work for Seth? Is that what it is?
No.
I remember you auditioned for SNL and then
that's
Seth
true.
Saw you. Yeah. Yeah.
But in between we lived in, LA for 2 years.
Uh-huh.
To try to make it.
Right.
It was horrible. It's terrible.
Was it a question between you and what's your husband's name?
Jan.
Between you, of course. was it a question between you and Jan whether you would be staying there in Amsterdam or whether you would, you know, whose career would take the lead or, you know, or because he can paint anywhere?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
He was like, yeah, let's do it.
Okay,
he
cool.
Didn't care. He's a pretty chill guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Great jokes.
You so 2 years in LA and it just, yeah. It's not a bad place to be broke.
Very sad.
You know?
It's a great place to be broke.
Yeah.
It is. That you have so much sunshine. And even though you have no money, your apartment is nice compared to New York.
Woo, absolutely.
You live in a little mansion.
Yeah.
It was great. I mean, I had a lovely time and I was a part of this theater called, what were we called? It's a theater called Sacred Fools.
Yeah.
Where it was like a writer's theater where you write most of your stuff and they put it up as the best. It was the best experience I could have got.
For what you do now, for sure, I bet. Yeah.
Absolutely. But then we auditioned for SNL and then I did not get it. I very didn't get SNL. And then I got Sam.
Because he was there, like he was there lurking in the back trying to poach people from SNL auditions.
Look, I think I didn't get SNL and he was like, oh, that's too bad. I'm going to give her this job so she doesn't cry.
What a sucker.
I was like, oh, no, I didn't get it. Like, okay, all right, come here. But I did, there was like four, you know how you audition and then you stay and then most of you go home. And there was four of us there. LaKendra, who went on to be a writer, Sashir Zameda, who got the job, Leslie Jones, who initially was a writer, and then me. And I'm the only one who didn't get SNL.
Anything?
Yeah. So I was like, even though you made it all the way to that point, because it was just the four of us for like 3 days, so it feels like I extra didn't get it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But then I think it turned out pretty good.
Yeah, I think so too. I think you probably, I bet you have, I'm just guessing, but I bet you have a more pleasant existence than the people that are working on SNL, because that's just, it seems like trying to, you know, like, you know, trying to serve eggs in a dryer, you know, like, you know, you're constantly tumbling around, you know, and you're trying to keep things precious and keep them together, you know.
Why in a dryer?
I don't know. I was thinking a tumbler, some tumbling thing.
It hurts. Do you have siblings?
I do.
Did they put you in the dryer?
No, I never got put in the dryer. You know what? I think I got in one once on my own, but like in college at a laundromat. So I can't really say it was like, you know, it was self-imposed torture. Why? Did you get put in the dryer?
Yeah, but I was game. I got to know what happened.
Yeah. All right. Hey, it's no fun. Problem. Yeah. Maybe I want. Yeah. Maybe someday I'll go over in a waterfall and a wheel and a barrel and I want to know what that's like.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I bet you. And also, I mean, it also just might be my perspective, because doing a daily show in that building is, I mean, it's different. Like, people, when I was there, people would complain. Because when we started, we did 47 weeks a year, 5 days a week.
Dang.
Yeah, it was a lot, like right off the bat when we started. And then also to be constantly under fire, you know, like the people that put you on the ship then sit on the shore and shoot cannonballs at you. But people at SNL would complain about how much work it was. And especially in the early days, we were so scared and we'd, you know, just put so much comedy into the show early on because we didn't know any better. And I would be just like, shut up, SNL people. You get the fucking summer off. We get 2 weeks at the most. And that's like once a year. And it's like, and also, but I did like that we couldn't be so precious about our stuff. Because it's got, it, you got to get it out there, you know? And it's like every night you got to, you know, it's more like a diner than fine dining. You just get the food out and it'll taste good, you know?
I feel like everyone feels that way about their job. But when you say 48 weeks, my
47.
God,
yeah.
47 is a lot.
I know.
We have 14 weeks off at Seth. 14. See that,
I just think it's just a different time. It's just like they just, yeah. And, you know, and I think that they were just like, they knew, I mean, Conan was coming from nowhere. So I think they just knew like, well, we can just make him do whatever we want. And yeah. He kind of gave off a whatever you guys want kind of vibe, which I learned like, oh, yeah, don't do that. Like, let the people know right from the beginning you got limits. Because otherwise, they'll be like, oh, we can fuck you. Oh, we will fuck you hard then, you know.
Learning.
but it was a lot. And especially because, like, in the early days, too, I was the one that did remotes in the first, you know, I did remotes for maybe like a year and a half before he ever started doing them because Robert Smigel thought it was too Letterman-y for Conan to go out. So it was like, let the kind of the dum-dum. And I mean, I mean that in just kind of like, I was kind of the dumb guy. You know, I mean, I wasn't, you know, I mean, I that was a persona I could put on for the comic value for the show. And like, let me go out and do the remotes. And I would sometimes do remotes. I'd do them on the weekends. And I remember there was one, and then I'd have to edit them myself because there wasn't like that structure yet. I was hired as a writer first, and I was still expected to put, you know, fill up spots on the grid, you know, like write bits and make sure that we had enough stuff to put on the show for the first couple of years. And then I was like, you know what, fuck this. This is too much. You know, nobody's going to fire me now. I'm on the show, you know? But I remember there was one, and it was like either 24 or 25 days in a row that I was working on, you know, putting that show together. Because like I said, I'd go shoot it all weekend, and then I'd come back and have to edit it until 2 o'clock in the morning because it would be on the show the next day. Yeah.
Oh my God.
We killed ourselves. The early days of that show, we had so much comedy. We would do like four acts of comedy. Just because that was where we were coming from. I mean, especially Conan being a writer, it was just, that's what, and Smigel pushing us. It was like, we made this kind of defensive wall of comedy while he and I figured out how to be on TV. Cause when we first got on TV, we sucked at being on TV. I look at tapes. I can't look at tapes of the first few shows. It's just too painful, you know?
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
But anyhow, how did your own show come about? Did you start to, was it because of your segments that you were doing on Seth?
We saw a slot open up at some time on NBC, and we were like, ooh, we should pitch. And this is Shoemaker's idea, who's the executive producer of Late Night Seth. Shoemaker is like, you should write up a proposal for a late night show and turn it in. And we did. And they were like, no, thank you. And then a year later, they were like, we're launching this thing called Peacock. Can we have that show you pitched? And we're like, oh, okay, great. Mm-hmm. So it was Shoemaker's idea to do a late night show. But Jenny and I really thought, you know, because you turn in so many sketches.
Yeah.
And most of them have to go in the garbage.
Yeah, yeah.
So we were like, we can certainly do a once a week show for sure.
Right.
Especially if we have other writers. So we do. And it's pretty great. It's four acts of comedy. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty easy.
Yeah.
I have to stop saying that, but it's true. But
no,
it's once a week, man, you can do once a week.
Yeah. Your co-host Tarek, where I don't know him. Where does he come from? Was he a...
Tarek is also a Boom Chicago actor.
Oh, okay.
So when I got hired at Boom Chicago the very first time, Tarek was there too. And we had just the best, you know, adventures all over Europe. It was the most fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, he also, I know he has this training of where I can give him a script and be like, read this over. You have 2 minutes.
It's going
to cards. Let's go. And he'll be like, yeah. And it does not care. You can't phase the man. You can't do it. So, yeah, it was. You learn. Not everybody can do that. So he's really talented. He also does a Broadway show called Freestyle Love Supreme, which is all like freestyle rapping, but it's on Broadway. And it is a Lin-Manuel Miranda show. And sometimes they have like Wayne Brady and like special guests who can improvise like songs and raps. It's the weirdest, best show.
Yeah.
But Tarek does that show and he does our show. It's really cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
You guys are great together. And I, you know, and being a fan, being for obvious reasons, a fan of like two people better than one person, because it is, it just, it's like you got so much more to do and it's just more fun to watch. And was there ever a consideration to do interviews on this show? Because that's such a staple of most late night shows.
No, absolutely not. We never thought to. Only because we were like, let's call it a late night show and really let it be a variety show. And then by the time they figure it out, it'll be too late. But if they ever make us do more than one show a week, if we get to keep doing the show fucking a month from now, I mean, let's start there.
Should that happen?
That'd be great.
Yeah.
But if we ever did end up doing the show more nights a week, then we would have no choice. We'd have to start interviewing people.
Yeah.
Because I don't know. I couldn't do no.
Oh, yeah.
Fucking 47 weeks a year, five days a week. Sounds insane to me.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a lot. It's a lot. So much of kind of your identity on Seth's show was, did it start with thing jokes Seth can't tell? Was that sort of when you first started getting on?
I think I started doing a bit called Amber Says What before that. And that was a recurring bit where I said, what in different ways in response to news stories. But I think that was before jokes Seth can't tell, but also before that, because we didn't start doing jokes Seth can't tell until Jenny worked here. And I don't think she worked here until like 2 or 3 years after the show started.
Mm.
So I had to be without her for that long.
Oh, no.
But when she started, it was off to the races.
Yeah.
And you would just rip up whatever you could get out of your brain into a script and send it to her. And she would do the rest. She'd send you her half idea. We just created this machine.
Yeah,
that we just fit each other's brains so perfectly that it became such a like fun factory. And when she came up with the idea for jokes Seth can't tell, I thought, what a fun bit to do at the Reed and never in front of other people. I thought there's no way we could do this in front of people.
Yeah,
but we did.
Yeah,
I'm still shocked.
Yeah.
At the end of every one of those, Seth goes, it's like my grandpa always said, black women and lesbians are liars. When he said that at the table read, I laughed myself sick. And then he did it at the rehearsal, and I laughed. I was like, he's got to stop saying that. He's going to accidentally say it in the show. He said it in the show. And I was like, we're dead. We're done. The show's canceled. I don't think he can say that. And the audience was like,
yeah.
All right. You like it. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, a lot of the, you know, I mean, a lot of your, of the stuff you guys do is topical and about like really awful topics and like really dreadful topics. And I mean like full of dread topics. Yeah. And from my perspective, and especially coming from the comedy that I've been doing most of my life, which is absurdist, silly nonsense. And we, you know, and we were on the air before, you know, there was a Daily Show that is kind of like the current Daily Show. You know what I mean? Like before topicality was seen as, you know, like serious topicality of really tackling issues in a comedic way was even done. So like if we had also, you know, if we had sort of tried to do that, I think we just would have looked, you know, we looked like we're chasing somebody's tail. But it's terrifying to me that you guys do this, because I find so much of what's in the news, just, I don't know how to make that funny. You know, I don't know how to make comedy out of George Floyd, you know? And I mean, is that, can you speak to like that mechanism in you, and I guess in Jenny too, and the staff to, I mean.
Yeah, I think it comes from like being Black.
Yeah.
I was like, because, you know, you come home from work and you're like, well, I got, like, I can remember when I got fired from I got a job at a sandwich place that will remain nameless. It's not the one you're thinking of, but the other one. and it was way out in West Omaha where all the white people were. And my parents were like, you do not want to work out there. There's too many white people. They don't want to see you, and you will be fired. And I was like, you guys are old as fuck. So I went out there. Sure enough, after like 2 weeks working there, the boss pulled me aside and was like, I had braids. She was like, your hair is gross. I think you should just straighten it, make it straight, you know, like the rest of you do. And I was like, oh no. And the next day I was fired. And I came home and I was like, Mom, Dad, you're right. And we laughed.
What was the reason? I mean, what reason did they give that you couldn't sue over? Or did you just know, like, you're not going to get a look?
They know I'm not suing. They know. But, and they didn't give me a reason. They did. They said that my drawers were never balanced. That's not true. Oh. But, you know, you got to say something. But yeah, like when you have to deal with stuff like that, you know what I mean? If you can see that as funny, then you're like,
those things pile up and pile up. And if you're going to be in like some sort of, you know, paralyzed with rage over that, you're going to have a real short life. So it's got to end up being, you know.
Yeah, and everybody has their own version of it. Jenny said the other day, she said something that knocked me out. She was talking about how she loved her little girlfriend a million years ago. She was like, but, you know, we couldn't get married because it wasn't legal. And I was just like, oh yeah. Oh, my God.
I know.
Yeah. Like, that shocked my face off. I was like, you just have to live like that. You go to bed, you wake up, it's still true. You can be sad all you want. It's not going to do nothing.
Yeah.
But I think that's how we, because, you know, you have to talk about all that stuff at home. And then Trump really makes you real good at it, because it was so hopeless for so long that it just got extra funny.
Well, and because it just, well, I mean, on one level, aside, you know, you cut, this is just one aspect of it, but like racism is so stupid. Like, it's just so dumb. It just doesn't even make any sense. That stripe of stupidity. Trump is like a farmer that like cultivated it and made it grow. And, you know, and it gave a lot of, well, I don't know if they're all stupid, but a lot of people's stripe of stupidity and gave them that permission to let it fly, you know? And I mean, I've said this before. I mentioned this on, I don't know if it was this podcast or one of the many I do.
Oh, yes.
But you know, I grew up in a very Republican area, and I was never really a Republican. I mean, I wasn't anything until I kind of, you know, got to be a young adult and started to figure things out for myself. But, you know, you'd see like a Republican road sign 20 years ago. It's like, okay, that, you know, I probably disagree with that person. And now they just seem sinister. Yeah. Like I was down by San Diego and I saw a Larry Elder yard sign and I was just like, that might as well be Voldemort. Like, what the, you know, like just the shit that Larry Elder says, it's like, how can you put that in your yard and be okay with it? It's like, it's to such an absurd level.
I know, it's sad and it makes it extra on your brain, you know, because of people want to put their signs out in their yard. Like that specifically is like, yeah. Ew, you keep this yuckiness alive. Whereas before, you never saw it. When nobody wore no hat or t-shirt, mm-hmm. Everyone was a normal until proven an idiot. But now it's everywhere. It's everywhere.
Yeah.
So it's a little extra sad.
Yeah.
But also a little extra safe because now I know what to do.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Well, you're not going to catch me.
It's, you know, I mean, I had the comfort of never, you know, just being a white male, a white cishet male, that I might have thought like, oh, you know, Republican, that doesn't necessarily mean racist. But now it's like, well, it's been made pretty clear that you're signing on to something that now is like, not even ostensibly racist, it's outwardly racist in so many ways. And it makes me think, it didn't change. Like, yeah. I was just comfortable in thinking like, oh, there's a little aspect of that. Like, no, there's like that Willie Horton ad. There was a reason for that Willie Horton ad. Like, that was the expression of something that was just there that was like, that to a certain number of white people is like, yep, I like that. Yeah, that's for me. So anyway, I mean, I when I watch your stuff, it's like you said, there's jokes that Seth can tell, but I mean, but just the ability to derive joy from what is happening in the world is just really a wonderful talent and a gift for everyone, you know. Good on you for doing it.
Thank you, Andy Richter. I love you so badly.
You're welcome. Well, so what do you have any big world owning plans at this point, or you just kind of gonna chug along?
Yeah, I learned not to make plans. Also, like nothing is scarier than this because, like, you don't know.
Yeah,
you don't. Is it gonna keep going? Is it gonna stop? Does it have to stop tomorrow? Like, what is happening? Will this go on forever? What is this?
Yeah.
So it keeps you on your toes. And I'm like, I don't need to be making any other plans.
Yeah. Yeah, you got enough keeping you busy. Yeah.
Yeah. I just got to keep chugging along. Like my old friend Andy Richter says. What are your plans?
I listen, I'm 54. Been divorced for 2 years. I was married for 25. I got a 15-year-old and a 20-year-old. And somebody said something about, you know, a year from now. And I was like, I don't even fucking know. I don't have any. I'm at like getting divorced was a big thing. You know, like if I hadn't gotten divorced, it's a different story. Like I would have kind of known, you know, like it's when you're in a marriage, you sort of, I mean, that was one of the, and I mentioned it, I just had Aisha Tyler on and we talked a lot about divorce and cause we're both failures. And I, you know, like one of the things that you don't anticipate is it's like a death of a future that you were holding on to. You know, it was my future. I had the same future in my mind for, you know, 25 years, 27, if you were together for 2 years before. And that was like, oh, well, that future doesn't exist. That future that seemed so like real. Like I thought about it so much, like where are we going to live and what are we going to do? And how are we going to, you know, how are the kids' lives going to still be in our lives? And it just, it goes away. So I don't know. I've got like, you know, my decks have cleared and I don't know what's going to happen. And very much the same way. And now, you know, having the Conan show just ended, that's another wrinkle. And I'm readjusting my mind to a freelance mindset because I was spoiled by 10 years of steady income. And I have to just calm that shrieking voice of like, I know I'm not making money, you know, like where's the check coming from, you know? Yeah. And also getting back to not being, you know, for me, it's, I got to figure out like what I want to do with myself. Like, am I just going to make myself available to some other situation and devote myself to that situation? Or am I going to be an author and sort of start to write my own story? And I don't know which is, you know, I might not be that author. I might just be like the guy, you know, I might be a utility player and I don't have any qualms about that. I love what I do. And I help out in lots of different ways. You know, I can help with the story and I can help with, you know, the dialogue and I can help with the way it looks in addition to performing. So, you know, I know how to make television. I know how to be on television. I just am not sure in what capacity it's going to be. So,
how exciting.
Yeah, exciting and terrifying. You know,
gosh, what is going to happen?
I don't know. I will keep you appraised. So the final of the three supposed questions, you know, it's just a format here. What have you learned? Like, what do you think is like the main lesson you've learned from, you know, from starting out in Omaha and ending up where you are now?
I don't know. I think the main lesson I've learned is to stay open and never make a single plan. Like, I certainly was not going to leave Omaha, but I never thought to cut off that possibility. Right. I was just like, hey, you know, I'm living life. Whatever happens, happens. Then once I got to Chicago, I was like, oh, well, who the fuck knows? Now it could be literally anything in the world. Yeah. And then Amsterdam happened. I was like, wow, did not see this coming. And then Second City happened. I was like, okay, never would have guessed this. Then Main Stage, I was like, this is it. This is the pinnacle of the back to Boom Chicago. Oh my God. And then I couldn't believe I gathered enough guts to move to LA to die slow there for 2 years. And then I couldn't believe it when I got Seth. It's all, I would never have guessed. I would have guessed wrong at every turn in my life, every last turn. Mm-hmm. So I don't have any plans for anything. But I know that I'm capable of literally anything. Yeah. So I think it's all right to not have plans.
Yeah, because I was, as you're sitting there saying like that, you know, all these accomplishments, all these like places that you end up and that you wouldn't have expected it. It sounds like somebody that's going, oh gosh, you know, I little old me, but you're not saying that. You're saying, yeah, all right. I wouldn't have thought, but I can do it. But yeah. I just didn't think the world worked that way where I'd get the chance to do it, you know?
Yeah.
Because you gotta, you know, you do have to believe in yourself. I don't know if anyone's heard that before. It's very helpful.
You revolutionary, you. Believe what? In myself?
Yeah, I've been tearing myself down daily. I thought that's what you were supposed to do.
You're telling me.
All right, Amber, I'm going to let you get back to work.
Okay. Do you have any ideas for like any topical sketches of any kind? See, now don't you feel good? You're feeling pretty good.
Yeah, I don't. I'm going to go to the grocery store. I don't have to think about, you know, from after this, I'm going to the grocery store. I don't,
oh, my God. In a car?
In a car.
Spoiled little piece of shit.
I know.
You're so lucky.
And then I'm going to pick my daughter up from school and my dog up from daycare.
Oh,
that's my, yeah. No topical bits. I don't have to think like, oh, let's make anti-vax funny today.
Yeah. You, sir, are living the life.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. And
Eddie Richter, thank you for having me. And I love you so bad. I've loved you forever.
Thank you.
You're part of my favorite show. I love you. I love you. I love you so bad.
I love you too. And and tell everybody there I said hi, and you know, and make a good show. And all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening to another episode of The Three Questions, and we will be back next week.
With more Amber Ruffin. Oh,
what?
I've got a big, big love for you.
The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It is produced by Lane Gerbig, engineered by Marina Pice, and talent produced by Galitza Hayek. The associate producer is Jen Samples, supervising producer Aaron Blayert, and executive producers Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson and Cody Fisher at Earwolf. Make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts.
Can't you tell my love's a growing?
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.